This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Terry Gross is in Louisville, Kentucky today, helping station WFPL celebrate their 40th anniversary. On the shores of Lake Tanganyika in the community of Gombe in East Africa live Melissa and Mike and old Flo and Fegan. The intimate details of their lives have been documented in articles in National Geographic and in books written by my guest, Jane Goodall. Goodall is one of the world's leading researchers on chimpanzees. She studied the same community of chimps in Gombe for the past 30 years. She's observed births and deaths, relationships, and wars. She was the first person to see chimpanzees eating meat, which contradicted the previously held view that they were vegetarians. Her 30-year project in Gombe is the longest unbroken study of an animal species in the wild. These days, Goodall is frequently called away from Africa to lobby and testify. She is working for the humane treatment of chimps in zoos and medical labs, and she hopes to have them reclassified as an endangered species. Jane Goodall has a new book about her 30 years with the chimpanzees of Gombe called Through a Window. Goodall has given names to these chimps, and she sees strong personalities and human-like traits in the animals. When Goodall began her study in 1960, the scientific community didn't recognize that animals had minds or personalities.
You see, right at the beginning, in the time of Darwin, for example, everybody just assumed that animals had minds and personalities, including the scientists. And then we had the American behaviorist school, started by Watson, who taught that animals were just machines, little bundles of stimuluses and responses. And that has been very hard to overcome, to return to the more common sense view, which all children know, that animals have minds and personalities. They are harder things to subject to cold scientific scrutiny than the rest of it.
Is there a danger at all of anthropomorphizing the chimpanzees you study? I guess seeing human qualities where they might not exist. Is that a temptation that you have to deal with?
Well, it's not a temptation, it's a fact. And I think here again, you see, science has been very quick to recognize the incredible similarities in the chimpanzee and human brain, the anatomy of the brain, the structure of the central nervous system, and all the other amazing physiological similarities. So it sort of stands to reason that you would find similarities in the emotions and the expressions of the emotions and in certain kinds of behavior and in intellect. And as far as intellect's concerned, then we now have a lot of nice, hard scientific information from studies in psychology labs, which do indeed show that chimps have all kinds of intellectual abilities that we used to consider unique to humans. And so we should be looking for human traits in chimpanzees and then sort of investigating them as much as we can to find out whether that's true.
After 30 years of working in Tanzania and in Gombe, who do the chimps think that you are?
I sometimes wonder, but basically, in the chimpanzees' world, the most important other living beings are other chimpanzees, particularly your family members, or if you're a young male, the top-ranking male is a very important figure in your life. And then after other chimps, there are, I suppose, the prey animals, because they're good for food, and young baboons and young chimpanzees play, and there are humans, and I think we're just one other part of their natural life.
How close do you get to them and their life, and is there even a kind of physical distance that you need to keep in order to keep that kind of, even that scientific objectivity?
Well, we try to keep a distance. It's not only from any scientific objectivity, it's because we want to interfere with their natural behavior as little as possible. Also, they're subject to catching our human diseases, so it's not good to get too close. However, the young chimps will often move across that barrier. They want to come and inspect and poke and stuff like that, and you try to ignore it. If it persists, you try to gently move away.
How do you spend your days when you are in Gombe in Tanzania? And I imagine those days are fewer and far between at this point.
Yeah, it's very sad how little time I'm able to spend there. But when I do get there, then I totally immerse myself in the chimps, getting up early, going to where they nested the night before, waiting for them to wake up, and following them as much of the day as I can. It's not always possible to follow all day because the country is pretty tough and rugged, and unless you're there all the time, you know, you actually have to get fit, and it's difficult to wriggle about on your tummy up and down steep slopes unless you're in good training.
Well, have you found over 30 years that it's harder and harder to kind of go where they go?
Not if I'm there for a reasonable length of time. You can get pretty fit in a week, but some of my trips recently have not been longer than a week, and then, yes, then it's harder, obviously. I mean, you know, one can't do quite what one did at 20 anymore.
Is it just a coincidence that you and Diane Fossey, you, of course, studying the chimpanzees, and Diane Fossey studying gorillas in their natural habitat, that you're women, and that women, in certain ways, have a temperament suited to the science of observation?
Louis Leakey specifically chose women. He felt that women were more patient and made better observers. And it's interesting, I've thought about this a lot. At the time when I was selected, it was a time when traditionally the male made the family and provided, and the woman became a wife and a mother. So that at that time, there was far less pressure on young women for making careers. So you could sit there, and as long as Louis Leakey provided the money, you could observe the chimps forever.
What variation and what differences did you observe in the child-raising techniques? And there are two mothers whose lives you have watched and whose offspring you've watched as well, and this is Flo and Passion. But I'd like you to tell us a little bit about the different kind of mothers that they were.
Well, they, as you say, were very, very different. Flo was, well, to start with, both of them, both Flo and Passion, were high-ranking in the female hierarchy, and they both were very assertive and could on occasions be aggressive. But other than that, they were very, very different, certainly as mothers. Flo was affectionate. She was very tolerant of her youngsters. She was not too restrictive. She allowed them to move out and explore, but she kept a very watchful eye on them and rescued them quickly if they got into trouble. She was very supportive too. And so she developed these very, very close bonds with her various children. Passion, on the other hand, was particularly with her first infant, Pom. She was very cold, extremely restrictive. She would get up and move away before Pom could properly walk, leaving the little infant on the ground whimpering. And it was only gradually, as Pom grew older, that Passion became a better mother to her.
So you've really seen then the kind of progression of that kind of mothering. I'm interested in what kind of then adults these children turned out to be.
Right, that's what's so truly fascinating, the tremendous importance that we see of the nature of early experience in the chimpanzee society, because we find indeed that Flo's youngsters grew up to be very assertive, self-confident. They attained high ranks, both males and females. And Fifi has turned into exactly the same kind of mother. She has the same maternal characteristics. She's the most successful female reproductively, and she also is high-ranking, assertive, and like Flo, has very good relaxed relationships with the adult males. Pom, by contrast, Passion's daughter, never became very assertive. She was a poor mother, like Passion, although not quite as heartless, and she never developed good relationships with the adult males. In fact, after her mother died, Pom, I think because she really didn't have a good place in the female hierarchy, emigrated and joined a neighboring group.
And in chimpanzee communities, are there mother substitutes or even a system of foster care, adoption, that kind of thing, where if a child is abandoned by their mother, that another mother will take over?
It's normally, if a mother dies, that the elder brother or sister will take care of the infant. And providing the infant's over 3 years and not totally dependent on milk, then that child has a chance of survival. However, some youngsters, even 5 years or more, become so depressed upon the loss of their mother. They show signs like clinical depression in grieving human youngsters and simply don't make it. The immune system is weakened, and they fall sick to some disease and die. we've had the most, probably the most touching story of all at Gombe over the 30 years was when a little infant called Mel lost his mother. He was 3 years old, had no elder brother or sister, and we all thought for sure that he would die. But what happened was truly remarkable. He was adopted by a 12-year-old adolescent male who, as far as we know, was absolutely not related to the family, had never spent much time with them. And yet this young male, that's like a human youth of about 15 or 16, he carried this little infant, he waited for him, he shared his food, he shared his nest at night, and he even ran the risk of being beaten up himself to run and gather up his little charge if he got in the way of the socially roused adult males, and saved his life.
Is this then compassion? I mean, is that what you observed?
This clearly is at least the kind of behavior from which true human compassion has sprung, but I would label it unhesitatingly compassion and altruism.
How do mother chimpanzees treat their sons differently from their daughters? And can you see them preparing them for a different kind of life?
No, I think it's actually mostly in the child. We find that the young males from an early age tend to be more prone to exploring, to leaving the mother earlier. They're fascinated from a very young age by the adult males, watching what they do and very often imitating them. They're fascinated by females in estrus, that's females who develop these pale pink swellings on their rumps. And the young female tends to be slightly less adventurous, slightly more gentle, slightly less violent in her play. Certainly there's a big difference at weaning, where the young male is likely to throw violent tantrums when he's rejected by the mother. The female is more likely to try and groom her way closer and closer to the forbidden nipple and seize a little suck.
Do you see the older males then playing any part in kind of initiating, I don't want to use that word too strongly, but initiating the younger males into male society?
Well, they serve that role, because when the young male starts to leave his mother, which he does between the ages of 8 and 10 usually, not totally leave her, but spend short periods of time, which gradually increase, away from her, he chooses to follow the adult males. And he'll very often choose one particular male and, in a way, sort of hero worship, in quotes, and imitate what that male does. And this is, of course, very beneficial for him, because if he stayed with his mother, he wouldn't learn the sort of things he needs to learn to be an effective adult male. He's got to learn about patrolling the boundaries of the community territory. He's got to learn about perpetrating attacks on neighbors to keep the territory secure or even to enlarge it. He's got to learn about some of the kinds of hunting that's usually done only by the males, like hunting young baboons or bush pigs. So if he just stayed with his mother, he couldn't learn those things.
You say that you've observed females, and this is, I guess, in courtship, that they actually seem to prefer some males to others. But I'm curious about what choice she has in the matter over courtship, whether it's anything besides just the timing of it.
She doesn't have that much choice. These young females who move back and forth from one community to another, of course, are helping to spread, helping to prevent too much inbreeding, because they may transfer permanently to a neighboring community. And sometimes they seem to do that because the males of their own community aren't too interested in them. But for the most part, when a female comes into estrus, she can be surrounded by most or all of the males of her community and mated by all of them one after the other. She can, to some extent, avoid certain males, particularly by approaching a higher-ranking male and hoping that his presence will inhibit the approach of the undesirable suitor. But unfortunately for the females, almost any male, if he's got any sort of social skill, can persuade her to follow him away from all the other males and take her to an outlying part of the community range and there try to keep her until she is fertile.
You write about a female chimpanzee, Gigi, who was sterile, and yet she had a profound effect on the community. And I'd like you to tell us a little bit about her.
Yeah, Gigi's absolutely an incredible character. She first began cycling in 1965, and regularly as clockwork, more or less, she's come into Estrus, been sexually attractive every month, and she's immensely sexually popular, so the males really cluster around her, and some females are much less popular, incidentally. But Gigi has all the sex appeal that could be desired. And because Gigi served to gather large, excitable male groups around her, then because they were gathered together, they were more likely to set off on these territorial patrols. And I think because Gigi served so often to bring them together, then there were perhaps more incidents of intercommunity aggression than there might otherwise have been. Because for a lot of time, adult males will wander about by themselves or little groups of one or two. And in that situation, they are most unlikely to go off on a patrol and engage in hostile relationships with their neighbors.
How has the violence and even the cannibalism that you observed in this colony of chimpanzees, how has that changed your understanding of who you thought chimpanzees were when you first started your research?
Well, I used to think, you know, as I spent month after month and saw more and more behaviors that so closely resembled ours, like the nonverbal communication where they touch, kiss, embrace, pat one another, hold hands, all the same sort of gestures as we use in the same contexts. And I watched these amazing long-term family relationships, the supportive relationships between mothers and youngsters and siblings. As I watched all this, I thought, yeah, they're very like us, but they're nicer. Yeah, they have some flare-ups between community members, and the males sometimes fight for dominance, but it's over quickly and it doesn't mean much. And then when I saw the first really brutal assaults by adult males on neighboring individuals, male or female alike, and saw the cannibalism, then I was shocked, I was saddened, but I realized that very sadly this makes them even more like us than I thought before.
Jane Goodall is my guest today. Her new book is called Through a Window. How would you say the chimpanzees of Gombe are threatened by either or and or tourism or development? How has that habitat changed in 30 years?
When I first got to Gombe, I could climb up to the peaks of the rift escarpment overlooking Lake Tanganyika, and all around I could see chimp habitat stretching out. Today, cultivation has come right up to the boundaries of the national park, and the three chimpanzee communities within the 30-square-mile reserve are now virtually isolated, well, completely isolated, from other chimpanzee populations, which isn't a very good lookout for the future. And in addition, tourism has been permitted, not too well controlled up until now. Now it's better. And chimps are susceptible to all human diseases. And because we'd been studying these chimps so long, because they were so habituated, this meant that they could get much too close to the tourists and run the risk of infection. And there are about over 1,000 fishermen camped along the shores of the lake in the national park, so that the chimps run the risk of contacting their diseases too. However, I think because I've used Tanzanians from local villages around the park to do the day-to-day observation, you know, taking a real central part in the research, using 8mm video cameras, they are caring about the chimps just as I am. They tell their families, and there's no way we get poaching at Gombe. So from that point of view, the chimps are very, very lucky compared to those in most of the rest of Africa.
If they are going to be cut off and isolated from other chimpanzee communities, what will happen, I guess, to their community? Will it develop traits that become rather idiosyncratic, do you think?
I suspect so. That's why I said that the view in the long term isn't so good, unless maybe sometime along the road we would manipulate nature, maybe introduce a couple of young females from different genetic stock. I don't know, but in the long run, I think the 150 chimps there is not a large enough genetic pool to sustain a population so tiny.
If chimpanzees are genetically and physiologically similar to us, do they have a place, do you think, in biomedical research?
Well, they are used in biomedical research. They're principally used in infectious disease research, studying the nature of the disease or its cure. And there is a lot of controversy, even among the scientists who are doing this research, as to whether chimpanzees are useful or not. However, although I'm not in a position to say whether chimps are useful or not, I am in a position to say that the conditions under which they're maintained in most labs in this country are absolutely, totally inadequate to imprison our closest living relative.
And how should they be changed? How would you like these chimpanzees then to live in laboratories?
Well, first, let me explain to those who don't know the complete horror that I've felt having watched them in the wild for 30 years on going into labs where the adult chimpanzees are confined in cages alone of 5 foot by 5 foot, 7 foot high, and that can be for a life of up to 50 years. And in those bleak cells, there is nothing, just steel bars. And, you know, they haven't committed a crime. We wouldn't keep our most hardened criminals that way. So we need much, much larger cages. We never should singly house chimps, and the virologists have actually published papers now saying that it isn't necessary. They should have plenty of objects to enrich their lives. They should have challenges. There should be some way they can control parts of their environment, even if it's only pressing one button gives you a drink and another button gives you food or a different kind of food.
But they need that kind of stimulation.
They do. I mean, I can assure you that a small chimpanzee child and a small human child pre-speech are really almost identical. I mean, they have the same desperate need for reassurance and love and contact. And to see them as I have seen them in this country, two-year-old chimps in cages measuring 22 inches by 22 inches and 2 foot high with nothing else in them, stacked up in quarantine, that is just outrageous.
What is left to do in Gombe? And I'm interested in how much time you can spend there now and what projects you are working on.
Well, the time I spend there is decreasing all the time, and it's partly from trying to raise levels of awareness about what chimps are here and in Europe. It's partly fighting for conservation in other parts of Africa where chimps are going so quickly. The challenge for learning about chimpanzee behavior, the greatest excitement, I think, lies in the fact that in different parts of Africa, chimps have different cultural traditions, different kind of tool usings, different use of inborn gestures in communication, different calls, even like a different dialect. And if we're not careful, we shall never learn a quarter of that fascinating cultural diversity, because the populations are vanishing. I mean, we'll never learn all of it because so many chimps have already gone.
Jane Goodall's new book is Through a Window, My 30 Years with the Chimpanzees of Gombe. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.